This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, more arrests likely in PNG over last month's storming of Parliament by police, as a small group that had been arrested have had their charges struck out, but they were rearrested shortly after. We're going to explain that in a moment. Also, Pacific leaders and small island nations turn up the heat in the final days of the crucial climate talks in Poland.
We are not prepared to die. We are not going to become the first victims of the climate crisis.
And we're going to take a close look at the twists and turns in Fiji politics this week, where opposition parties are challenging elements of last month's national election, while government MPs were literally camped out overnight on foam mattresses, attending what's been called a 48-hour strategic meeting.
This one is very peculiar and it raises a lot of scepticism and really a lot of questions from the general public considering the timing. It's created a lot of public perception around the sense of trust that people have in what was done.
And more on that story and much more coming up here on Pacific Beach. Good morning, I'm Catherine Grau. First, though, a group of police officers in Papua New Guinea who were arrested after allegedly storming Parliament have had the charges against them struck out by the court, only to be rearrested a short time afterwards. More than 300 police and correctional officers stormed PNG's Parliament shortly after the country hosted the APEC summit last month, angry about what they said were unpaid allowances for working during the event. 12 officers appeared in court yesterday charged with stealing items from the Parliament. Our PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting is in the capital, Port Moresby. Natalie, what happened in court?
Well, this was the first court appearance for this group of 12 police officers who were arrested after the rampage through Parliament. So that's the only 12 arrests we've seen so far, and they were all on charges of stealing goods from Parliament. But in this first appearance in court, the case was actually struck out because of some errors in the information provided by police prosecutors around the date and location of the offences. And so those errors, defence argued, meant the case should be struck out, and it was.
That happened, but I understand they were all then charged again.
Yes, that's correct. So shortly after leaving court, they were arrested and charged again by this police team that's been set up to investigate what happened at Parliament. So the police have said that despite a moment of elation from those charged officers, that was quickly subdued when they were recharged shortly after leaving court. However, that was only 11 of them. One constable has escaped from the courthouse, but police say that they expect that officer to be arrested and charged again shortly.
And beyond that, are we expecting to see any more arrests as well over the unrest? Given on that day, we actually saw hundreds of police officers and correctional services personnel there at Parliament.
Yes, that's correct. And the Commissioner of Police has come out and said it was more than 300 police and correctional services officers who took part in this storming of Parliament. So 12 of 300, they obviously have still got a fair few people that are being investigated. So there is a special task force that has been set up and that investigation is ongoing. We've heard that they're currently reviewing CCTV and vision from inside Parliament to help with that investigation. But yes, I think people are expecting to see more arrests.
So PNG correspondent Natalie Whiting there on the line from Port Moresby. Leaders from the Pacific and small island nations across the world are upping the pressure in the final days of the COP24 climate conference underway in Poland, warning they're not ready to die in the fight against climate change. Overnight, 15 Pacific small island developing states appealed for nations to take dramatic and urgent steps to decarbonise the global economy, saying that the summit's a pivotal moment in human history. Now, on Friday, that's going to be Saturday for much of the Pacific, is the last official day of the summit, and nations are yet to reach consensus on how they will reduce carbon emissions. Our reporter Yara Murray-Atfield's been following the talks since they started a fortnight ago. Yara, what is on the line at the conference?
Good morning, Catherine. Well, so as listeners have been hearing for the past fortnight, COP24 has been underway in Katowice in Poland. That's the event that happens each year. Fiji was the host of COP23 last year, and it brings together leaders from around the world to try and reach consensus on how to tackle climate change. The United Nations says that this year is one of the most important summits ever. And amid the list of goals, the main aim is to come up with what's been dubbed a rulebook. So to refresh listeners' memories, this comes 3 years after the Paris Climate Accord was signed. And that's where countries pledged to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, this conference is trying to get countries to agree on actually how to do that. So the urgency of reaching an agreement's been made all the more stark by the IPCC special report on that target. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has warned that the world is not on track to reach those targets and that if we exceed them, it could be really dire. The picture painted is of extreme weather, drought, coral bleaching. The word used by the report authors is catastrophic. One of the major hurdles earlier in the week has been getting everyone to sign on to that report, and some of the major nations like the United States, Russia and Saudi Arabia have actually blocked its signing.
Now, Yara, the talks will come to an end this weekend. How are they actually going?
Well, that's the question. So the conference works on consensus. So everyone needs to sign on to any agreement or deal, or it simply just won't be done. So I mentioned the rule book, but one of the big things for Pacific nations and small island developing states has that they've been pushing for is actually funding for climate resilience, but more specifically, funding for money to respond to the loss and damage caused by climate-related events. Here's how Vanuatu's Foreign Minister Ralph Regenvanu said the negotiations were going a few days ago.
They're not going very well. We were briefed this morning by our negotiators, the Pacific ministers, and there seems to be quite a lot of issues of deadlock at the moment.
And so on that same day, the president of COP admitted that the negotiations were being stuck in the fine details, and he said he would take control of the talks. He urged people to look at the big picture rather than getting caught up in what he called the brackets. And Catherine, since then, we've had Pacific and climate vulnerable nations really upping the pressure. So that's including the High Ambition Coalition, which has more than 20 members. It's led by the Marshall Islands. That group is calling for people to increase their targets, and they're leading the way by announcing their own plans of being entirely carbon neutral within decades. We've also heard from Mohammed Nasheed, who's the president of the Maldives, and that's an island nation in the Indian Ocean. Overnight, he's really hammered home the idea that this is life and death for many of these climate vulnerable nations.
We are not prepared to die. And the Maldives has no intention of dying. We are not going to become the first victims of the climate crisis.
And so overnight, it does appear that some progress has been made. People on the ground are saying that the document has gone down from more than 200 pages to 136.
Well, yeah, the pressure is certainly being increased by island nations, as we heard there. What about, though, Australia's role?
Well, so at the Paris climate talks in 2015, Australia aligned itself with that High Ambition Coalition. This year, it's a bit of a different story. Although the Environment Minister, Melissa Price, says we will meet our climate targets, Australia won't actually be raising our commitments. Simon Bradshaw is Oxfam Australia's climate change specialist. He's been in Katowice for the talks, and he says that's different to what we say our commitments are to the region.
If we look at this from the perspective of our region here, we've seen some determined efforts from Pacific Island countries and other vulnerable countries to catalyze greater ambition to say, hey, look, we're willing to lead. We're increasing our commitments before 2020. We're setting our path to 100% renewable energy. And then you have Australia still dragging its heels. Even back in Canberra, while this is going on, we've had signals the government will underwrite new coal-fired power. Over here, the government's stubbornly refused to start lifting its contribution to the Paris agreements. So we really do see a yawning gulf between the expectations and real leadership from Pacific Island countries and what we see happening in Australia. And that's very significant in the context of our relationship with the region. There's been a lot of talk all year about Australia wanting to remain a trusted partner of the Pacific family, and a very clear signal from many Pacific leaders that, look, climate change is the number one security, livelihood, threat to our region. And if Australia is to be a member of the Pacific family, we have to up our game.
So that's Oxfam's Simon Bradshaw there. And Catherine, an agreement isn't always made at talks like this, so it is looking like it will go down to the wire over the weekend.
Indeed, that's our Pacific beat reporter Yara Murray-Antfield there. And ABC Radio Australia will keep you up to date with the developments at the COP24 climate conference as they happen. Fiji's acting Prime Minister, Aya Syed Kayum, has explained why government MPs were literally camped out in his office earlier this week. He's claimed that they were attending a 48-hour strategic meeting, but it coincided with attempts by opposition parties who've been attempting to serve an election petition on 27 Fiji First MPs, as they've been ordered to do so by Fiji's Court of Disputed Returns. But the opposition parties and their legal team claim that they were obstructed from doing so this week, with security at the building not allowing them in where the MPs were meeting. SADELPA and the National Federation Party filed the petition right at the start of this week on Monday. And that petition includes claims of unlawful conduct by Fiji First candidates during the election campaign period and also alleged breaches by the Supervisor of Elections. Of course, the mid-November poll was narrowly won by the Fiji First Party, with just over 50% of the votes. Now, but what was to happen to this election petition during the week came under a cloud of doubt because the opposition had been unable to personally serve it to all of the respondents as had been requested. And yesterday, though, under tight security, judges gave the opposition parties a reprieve by allowing them to advertise it in today's newspapers instead. Here's how the General Secretary of the SADELPA Party, Lithia Gyanribavi, and the leader of the NFP party, Biman Prasad, responded after the court's decision yesterday.
We're thankful that the court has ruled this morning that substitute of service is approved and must be published in the two dailies.
We're happy with the ruling by the court. Obviously, the technique used by the Fiji First ministers and MPs to hide away from our bailiffs and us so that we could save the petition has not worked for them.
It's Biman Prasad there. Well, the Attorney General, Aya Syed Kayum, who's also actually acting Prime Minister at the moment while Frank Bainimarama is overseas, says that it wasn't a tactic. They weren't hiding, but it was a previously arranged meeting.
For the past 2 days, we've been meeting for over 48 hours. There was a strategic meeting which was planned some weeks back to get the synergies involved, identify what we call the low-hanging fruits in terms of what we can deliver, not just as a government, but also in terms of economic output, but also the medium to long-term output, and do the strategic thinking.
Aya Syed Kayum there speaking about what he described as that strategic government meeting. It was held over 48 hours while the Prime Minister is overseas, as is the country's Defence Minister. Pacific Beat has attempted to speak with Mr. Syed Kayum to discuss this week's events, but those attempts have not been successful. Jopa Tarai is a Fiji politics expert at the University of the South Pacific, and I spoke with him a short time ago to get his analysis of the week's events.
I think it's been a very interesting week, as you said, and a lot of people have really been switched on, especially the general public. I think the turning point for this week was Wednesday, when Islands Business and a few other media organizations had alerted the public to the fact that the cabinet ministers appeared to have held themselves up in Level 9 Swabo House. From Monday to Tuesday, it was more a legal progression how things, but by Wednesday, it really became a public affair for everybody. So it really raised a lot of eyebrows. It really raised a lot of questions about the intention of having such a, what we now are told is a strategic meeting, and not having it being informed or told to the general public that it was a strategic meeting at the time.
And there have been, as you say, now we know that this is being described by the acting Prime Minister, Aya Syed Kayum, as a strategic meeting. Now, of course, there's been plenty of criticism and cynicism from the opposition and its opposition parties and its supporters about that meeting and why the MPs were holed up for 48 hours, essentially. Now, do you think it is unusual that a meeting that's described as a strategic meeting would be held while the Prime Minister is actually out of the country? And also, I guess, why in an office as opposed to perhaps a hotel where people can actually sleep? But having said that, it is a new government. It's only just formed. It's the end of the year, and it's not unusual for any government to want to try and meet before the end of the year to formulate their plans, particularly for the new year, and no less so than a new government, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely correct. It's not different from any government having to have meetings, but this one is very peculiar and it's, as you've said, raises a lot of skepticism and really a lot of questions from the general public considering the timing. And also because of the fact that during the meeting, the public were not informed of what was the intent of the meeting, especially in the backdrop of having the petition to be served. I think all in all, it's raised a lot more questions than answers. And it's created a lot of public perception around the sense of trust that people have in what was done and also the timing of what was done. And the bigger question also is why wasn't the Prime Minister waited upon to have that meeting, considering that he is, after all, the head of government and the Minister of Defence not being there. So generally, in as far as the public is concerned, it appears that a lot of the discussions about the strategic meeting or whatever the content of the meeting was is really looking more and more weak as an excuse or as an explanation. And also because most of the images that were released to justify or try to prove that it was a strategic meeting has created a lot of online users to question a lot of the backdrop. There's images of mattresses in the back that were attempted to be conveniently sort of hidden away. There are images of some of the cabinet ministers looking very tired. And so it really raises more questions and a lot of trust issues from the general public to the intent behind the meeting.
Now, beyond all of this drama and the questions about whether this was truly a strategic meeting or, as is claimed by the opposition, a tactic to ensure that the petition couldn't be served to those Fiji First MPs, what still remains here is a very crucial element that we've not actually seen a lot move forward with this election petition that's been filed by the opposition parties. They filed it on Monday, and under Fiji's constitution, from that day, there's only 21 days for a judgment to be delivered. So, given we're at the end of the week now, there's only 16 days for that. We've got Christmas, the holiday period basically here upon us. So do you think this is likely to be dealt with in that time frame and be able to be dealt with comprehensively given that short timeline?
That's the big question that everybody's wondering. And it's quite clear that some critics have argued that this is a clear strategy to try and buy as much time as possible and grind down on the time in order to deny any sort of enough time to make a judgment. But I think one of the judges had made a comment that the representatives or legal representatives will have to forget about their holiday because the next 16 days now at this point is going to be very crucial for the High Court to ultimately make a decision on the case by the 31st. So it's anybody's guess, but definitely time is running out. And a lot of these so-called tactics or hide-and-seek strategies appear to be killing more time than it is having to help the case proceed accordingly and give the court enough time to make a decision.
Strepe Tarai from the University of the South Pacific.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
To Nauru, where a government appeal against the permanent stay in the case of the protest group that's known as the Nauru 19 will now not be heard this year. The Nauru government was set to challenge a decision that was made by an Australian judge, Geoffrey Mooker, in September when he set aside all the charges linked to the anti-government demonstration that happened outside Parliament more than 3 years ago. In his 100-page judgment, Justice Mooker accused the Nauruan government of persecuting the 19 and putting obstacles in the way of a fair trial. Now, the former Foreign Minister of Nauru, Matthew Batsuya, is one of the 19. He says the delay in bringing the lengthy legal proceedings to an end once and for all is frustrating. He spoke with Richard Hewitt.
We were scheduled to commence the government appeal against the Supreme Court decision, but that's abandoned. So that's going to be rescheduled sometime next year. The lawyers and the prosecutors are having discussions with the court to figure out exactly who is available when, and then they'll fix the time then.
Is there a reason or reasons why the hearing has been cancelled and put back in this way?
We weren't given any reason. It's just been that we've heard one of the judges supposed to come in from PNG. I was not able to come at that time. That's what we've heard, but nothing official has come out from the courts.
So in terms of the Nauru 19 situation and particularly the legal counsel acting for the group, does it impact on their preparations at all? Or will it make any difference to their ability to present the case?
It won't affect their ability. I mean, they stand ready, whether it's next week or next year. We prefer the appeal to be heard sooner rather than later. It's been hanging over our heads and basically paused our lives for the last 3.5 years. So the sooner we get through the appeal and have it done, the better.
Is there any suggestion at all that the government might opt to just give up at this stage, or do you think they're determined to go through with this?
I think it's too late now. I think they've committed to the appeal and they've lodged all the paperwork that's needed. And so I think nothing will change from that standpoint. The government's committed to appealing and we stand ready to defend the decision from Judge Mutu.
And what is the current situation as far as former President Srettan Thabo is concerned, still being treated in Thailand, I presume? I mean, has the question of who will pay for that treatment been resolved?
The government has made it clear that they won't be funding the treatment. Sprint needs the treatment. It's a life-saving treatment. So other options are being pursued for Sprint in that regard because he needs the treatment. Otherwise, it won't look good for Sprint. So the life-saving treatment. And unfortunately, the government has said no to funding his treatment.
So is it too simple to suggest that what is happening here is basically a fundraising campaign now on his behalf?
Yeah, I mean, we've been fundraising for Sprint as trying to assist him and looking for options for Sprint. But there are people willing to help Sprint as well. So without the support of our government, the alternative methods for funding his treatment has to be sought.
And is there any contribution, for example, coming in from supporters outside Nauru?
Supporters in Nauru and outside Nauru everywhere. Sprint has a lot of friends and supporters, and they see the injustice in the matter. And so Sprint needs this treatment, and it's life-saving treatment.
That said, therefore, I mean, what's the latest on his condition? How is he faring?
I haven't got an update yet, but Sprint's not well. But we'll see how things come out in the next few days.
And just to go back to the Nauru 19, it's been a long, drawn-out affair, and you just have to be patient for a little longer, I guess?
Well, the good thing is that we've got the stay, so the status quo is that permanent stay is enforced, and so we've got no bail conditions on our part, and so we're free. We've applied for passports. That hasn't been successful because the government is still unwilling to issue a passport, but that's another matter. But we do need the appeal to proceed so we can have it finalised and then we'll see from there.
Matthew Batsoe is a former Nauruan foreign minister, also one of the defendants in the Nauru 19 legal battle, speaking there with Richard Hewitt. There's been a huge decline in the number of sharks off of Australia's east coast. New research published today shows that up to 92% of some species have been lost in 55 years, and experts suspect overfishing might be responsible, as George Roberts reports.
A 33-year-old man has died after a shark attack in North Queensland.
It hasn't reached peak swimming season yet.
Good evening to Breaking News. And two people are tonight in the fight of their lives, attacked by a shark in the very same harbour.
But a series of high-profile attacks off Queensland and New South Wales lately may give the impression shark numbers are on the rise. But the facts prove otherwise. Dr. Roth is from the University of Queensland.
The results are quite striking. So what we found over the last 50 years is a dramatic decline in the numbers of apex sharks on the Queensland coastline. So the number of large sharks on our beaches have declined by between 74 and 92%. And at the same time, the size of the sharks are also getting smaller. So there are fewer and smaller sharks on Queensland beaches than there were 50 years ago. And this includes the globally endangered hammerhead sharks that have declined by up to 92%. And importantly, white sharks that are listed as vulnerable in Australia have shown no sign of recovery since, despite protections that have been put in place over 2 decades ago to stop fishing.
What do you think is behind this decline?
We think it's strongly linked to targeting of sharks in recreational commercial fisheries, also in bycatch and commercial fisheries. And again, the shark control programs in Queensland and New South Wales are removing large individuals from the waters.
So do there need to be better protections for sharks?
We think there's better ways of making people safer on Queensland beaches than old-fashioned blunt tools and methods such as shark control programs that use baited drum lines and nets to keep people safe.
He and his co-author, Dr. Chris Brown from Griffith University, found that so-called control methods have seen tens of thousands of sharks killed.
So they've obviously removed a lot of sharks, 55,000 sharks over the last 50 years or so. So that could be affecting their abundances.
That's a phenomenal amount, isn't it?
Yeah, over the years, yeah.
And are those shark numbers likely to recover?
Well, we're not seeing any evidence of recoveries at the moment. So this has been an ongoing decline for about 50 years now across all these different species.
They say baited drum lines and other deadly methods should be replaced with newer technologies. Dr. Roth again.
But there's no evidence really to suggest that shark culls work. And similarly with shark control programs, there's no particular scientific evidence to show that when you decrease shark populations, you decrease the likelihood of having shark attacks on our Queensland beaches. New South Wales have been leading the way with implementing smart technology in the form of drones that will sit on top of the beaches and actively spot for sharks, and clever boys that sit within the water and they use sonar to detect sharks coming into the beaches where there are beachgoers. And if we can implement modern technology and smart technology like New South Wales has done, we can have smart, safe beaches in Queensland and still have large sharks roaming our coastlines.
It's Dr. George Roff from the University of Queensland. George Roberts reporting there. That's all for Pacific Beat this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. You have a great weekend.